of Text.
Welcome one and all to the Titans of Text podcast. We are your host, Eric Ostrich.
And Danny Austerity Nissenfeld.
And we have with us today Doc, game designer, narrative designer, article writer, and overall font of hot takes. If you were looking for the aforementioned takes, you're in for it tonight. Welcome, Doc.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So before we get down to questions, game design, of all that stuff, tell us a bit about what you've done and the games that that people might know that you've worked on.
Very long time ago, I commented a lot on Kotaku. That's what everyone should know. No, I commented a lot enough there that somebody said, "Hey, you should actually do games writing." And he is a very well respected games writer guy because he writes about more than games. I won't name him, but more like a proper journalist than a games journalist, like in terms of what he covers. He was like, "Hey, you random internet commenter, I think you could be a writer." And I was like, "Really?" He's like, "Yeah." And he encouraged me to submit a piece. I wrote to Kotaku. I'd written to a bunch of different people, but I tried Kotaku and I was like, "Hey, you featured my community posts on the front page more than anyone else. That means you think I'm front page material. So why don't I do some freelancing for you?" Which is the ballsiest thing I'd done in my life up to that point. And they let me. So for about 7 years, I've written design stuff for Kotaku. Not as much the past couple of years, branched out, tried, you know, US Gamer, just got some stuff done, Vice, stuff like that. So I did a lot of journalism, but it was a lot of journalism about how games work. And that got the attention of a company called Hit Detection, who does AAA game consulting. And I obviously can't talk about their clients at all. But they hired me to start helping some people out making their games better. So I had this like natural progression of writing cool articles about how games work to helping people make better games. Some of those games are pretty well beloved. And then after that, I lost my home. The reason being, consulting work is few and far between when you're remote. And I did not have a lot of opportunities, so I ended up losing my home. And I was like, what do I do? So I pitched an idea for a game on Twitter. That game ended up being a collaborative project called Paratopic, which Vice called, this is before I was writing for Vice, so it's not a conflict of interest. Vice called it probably the most important first-person game in 2018. We won an IGF award. We were up for a couple. I think Onion's AV Club said we were, you know, incredible game. Tim Rogers over at Kotaku, which probably is a little bit of a conflict of interest, but I wasn't really working there at the time. He had it in his roast of the year and said everybody should play it. Like a lot of people seemed to like it. And we kind of, I think, kickstarted a PlayStation 1 style horror first person revolution. So there's a bunch of games out there now that are like PS1 horror classics. There was like a big explosion just all at once, you know, within like a year after we release. So Paratopic's probably the one the most people know about, at least within the indie space. Like, you know, a lot of big YouTuber dudes who I'd never heard of because I don't really do YouTubing. Vinesaw, Super Best Friends, like a bunch of people covered our game. So we got a lot of attention, which was cool. I've done freelance narrative design work for a few people. The only one I can really talk about is Hard Space Shipbreakers, which is by Blackbird, a company that makes they made the Homeworld Deserts of Karak. It's a bunch of former original Homeworld creators from Relic that are kind of doing their own thing now. So yeah, I did a shitload of narrative stuff for Hard Space, and it was just absolutely wonderful to see that at PAX and see people playing it and hearing my dialogue in game. That was cool. Now I'm working on a game called Adios, which is a first person game about a pig farmer who's decided he no longer wants to dump bodies for the mop. So it's a first person game where you talk to the person who has to kill you if you decide to go through with your plan, and you go around doing stuff on the farm. And we have DC Douglas, who's the voice of guys like Kamoshida, the first boss in Persona 5. He's in Monster Hunter Ace Combat. He's Wesker, Albert Wesker, in games like Resident Evil 5. We have him as one of our characters. And then we have this wonderful guy, Rick Zeef, who I hadn't encountered in a lot of games, but it turns out he's the guy at the beginning of Resident Evil 3 who, like the remake, who hides in the truck and is like, "I'm not getting out of here. I'm going to stay safe while this is, you know, all this is over." Dario Russo, I think the character's name is. But yeah, Rick is amazing. Not a dry eye in the house for some of those scripts, which made me happy. So yeah, we're doing that. Just kind of as an experimental narrative game, because we got kind of enough funding to do that, and that's the cheapest kind of game you can make in 3D. So that's what we're doing now, and I'm hoping, you know, eventually to get back into making shooters. That's me. That's my career.
Sorry, I remember when you had the voice actors for Adios in the studio, in the sound studio, and you were tweeting about that at some point.
I was losing my shit.
Tell me a little bit about how that went.
You know, when you write a script, you have a voice in your head, right? You write a script down and you kind of, people have talked about this before. It's like, here's narrative voice. And it's this person in your head that if you tried to put an actual voice to it, you wouldn't necessarily know who it is. So I was doing that, but because I'm a writer and I'm writing what is essentially a stage play, except set around a huge interactive environment. Huge is like Assassin's Creed Odyssey. This is a single farm, but it's a single farm. So there's a lot going on. It is, I don't know how to put this. When you're writing a script, you start having like no voice, right? Or you have line readings in your head. I tend to read my scripts aloud. Like when I'm writing them, I act them out to make them sound more like dialogue. Cause sometimes you'll find when you're quoting yourself, you're like, oh shit, that line doesn't make sense. Like it looks good on paper. And then when you say it, it doesn't sound natural. So I'd written this thing out, I'd worked on it, but I had no idea how it was going to be for people to do it. And then, you know, the guy's fucking talking about, you know, life or death type situation. He's talking about, you know, morals. He's talking about why he quit the Vietnam War. He's talking about things that would spoil the game. Like he's doing all this stuff and he's fucking delivering it with this like pathos, right? And there were times where I'd hear the line and I'd go, this isn't what I wanted. And I try to communicate what it is, and he'd just fucking knock it out of the park every time. And that's what both of those actors did. And then we got a couple more for a couple smaller roles in the game. And it's making me it's just amazing. Like to hear something you've written and to hear someone like become the character to bring that person to life. That's a very cliche way of putting it, but I understand why people say it now. Like, because that's what it is. That is the process. I hope that makes sense.
No, it absolutely does. In a former life, I was running theater troupes and wrote stage plays and performed and put them on across South Florida, which is where I grew up. One thing I'm interested in, because you mentioned that it's like a stage play. It's in that small scene. Well, I know farmers are pretty big. I live in the Midwest. I know how big farms can be, but compared to, you know, games people are used to, like an MMO or something, it's probably not enormous. So it's a stage. Relating back to the writing, the voice in your head, the voice actors acting it out, how do you feel about the, I know there's a theater term for this and I can't remember it, kind of like the delegation of character design, of character motivation, and of character direction. Because you've written a thing, you obviously have what it's supposed to be in your head, but then you give that to someone and you trust them to create the character, you know, to take that further than you were thinking about.
Well, like, there's a couple different, there's so many ways to attack any question, right? Not attack, but like, you know, attack a problem, yeah. Right? Not,
yeah.
So on one hand, like I'm paying them, right? That's the simplest answer. I'm paying them so I can get what I want, right? But that's not really what it is. But it does mean, like when I was doing indie projects for no money, I felt like I couldn't push back because everyone was working for free, right? So how picky can you be when people are just doing this on their own free time to, you know, hope maybe to ship some, you know, itch project or something? So when you get to sit down with like real actors and they are booked for a certain amount of time and you have like an audio engineer and a voice director and yourself, and you're all sitting there and you're just Nelson was there too, he's our producer, so when we're all sitting there like listening, we can kind of hash things out, right? And so I've written the story and I have a conclusion we're building towards, right? As I write these characters out, I know some people who do like character sheets first and then try to make all the lines fit that. I try to be more organic. I try to be like, okay, I know what the end of the story is, and I kind of have a sense of who these people are, and then I kind of mold them over time. It's like clay. And so, you know, I get to a point where it's like they're saying lines for a certain reason. They have reasons to say these lines that they're not saying. It's subtext. It's, believe it or not, the guy who wrote, one of the guys behind Lost, I think it was Lindelof himself, said he writes every character with a secret. He doesn't need to talk about that secret at all, but it's something that informs their performance. Whether or not it's even in the work itself, he writes them with that secret so that it changes who they are as a person, like how those lines are delivered. And of course, in Lost, they examined pretty much everybody's secrets just to see who they were, because that's what that show is about. But for me, it's like I kind of sat down. I have a line in there where Hitman just says, Roy would have been about his age. And Farmer just goes, yeah. And that's like all you hear about that. And they asked me what that meant. And I was like, oh, Roy was Hitman's son and he passed. And since Farmer and Hitman have this relationship where they're kind of friends, because this guy's been delivering bodies to his farm for, you know, 20 years or whatever, Farmer knows, and Farmer is sad about it in a way. And that feeds into the rest of the conversation. And the great thing about these actors are these guys are fucking pros. And they're like, oh, so it ties in the script like this, this, and this. They pick up on a lot of what you're trying to do. And I'm really lucky that a lot of what I wanted came through in the script without being a direct, like, I am sad because I have a problem. Like, it's, I wanted to avoid the Marvel school of film writing. I remember having this argument with this person on the internet, which you should never do. You should never have arguments on the internet. I know from experience. Where, like, he said, Mad Max Fury Road isn't as good as Marvel movies. And I was like, what? He's like, yeah, because in Fury Road, nobody tells you what their motivations are. They just kind of do things. And in a Marvel movie, yeah, exactly, right?
Wow.
In a Marvel movie, like, Tony Stark will be like, I have alcoholism, and that's why I'm depressed. And you're like, well, that's bad writing. Like,
No kidding.
Fury Road is like one of the best movies ever, because it does like Kuleshov effect, it does like all this shit that's just a simple shot of like a person looking at something really quickly gives you a sense of who they are. The uncanny zoom up to Immortan Joe early on in the film, there's just this zoom that makes him look really intimidating. It just creates an effect. Like, there's a reason that we do what we do in movies, and it's why we do in games and anything else. We don't want to just explain things, because we're trying to give people feelings, because we want people to, you know, arrive at a place. So when it comes to working with the actors, it was like trying to get the actors to understand what feeling I was going for in each scene. And the great thing was, because these guys were so fucking pro, usually it didn't take any time at all. Like, there were several scenes in the game they actually nailed in one take. There were times where they'd be going, and then somebody'd be like, do you want to stop now? And he'd be like, no, let's keep going. We got to flow. Let's go. We were really lucky in that we got the two of them to record together. Most games don't do that, because they tend to book actors separately and stuff like that. We had COVID going on, but we managed to get both guys recording in home studios through like some sort of online service. And so while we have their lines separately, we actually were able to get them recording together, which meant they could bounce off each other. And it brought the lines out in a way that felt really good. So that's the really long answer. You know, short answer is I'm paying them. The long answer is so much of it is about the writing and then getting the actors to understand the writing. And I'm so lucky that DC and Rick were just as professional as they were. They could immediately, they were like, oh, I get what you're going for here. And there were a couple times where they were like, wouldn't it be better if I approach the line maybe like this? Or sometimes you're like, wait, hold up. I'm gonna give you like four different readings of this line. Let's see which one you like best. So sometimes it was them trying to help us out by like just giving us options. Like a really good, you know, restaurant guy. Not a waiter, the fancier guy who brings you fucking, you know, a wine thing, and then you're like, what wine is best? And he's like, oh, so I believe, you know,
Somalia.
You should have. Yeah, that guy.
The wine, yeah, sommelier.
Yeah. It's like a sommelier, right? They were doing that, except with dialogue. It was great. But for me, I knew I didn't want to be, you know, I didn't want to be like David Fincher, who tries to break his actors down By making them do scenes over and over again arbitrarily until they get the performance he wants. Like, I was like, here is your goal in the scene. Like, emotionally, here's what the audience needs to feel. Emotionally, here's what you're feeling. Here's why you said what you said. Now, what performance they bring out of that, I kind of let them do it. And I wanted to trust them with it. I figure if I'm making a game, I'm collaborating with people, and they've been doing this for years, they may even know better than me what they should do. I'd only ever heard DC like do things like Ace Combat, where he's very anime. There's this great, great scene in Ace Combat 7 where he names your enemy pilot, who's been named Mr. X for the game. The guy has like 17 names. Like, it's Mihaly, Dimitru, etc. There's like 40 of those. And one of them is just an A with a period after it. Like, every other name, it's all the way out. And he delivers it in this way that is, I don't know if it's comic or not, but it's very anime, and it made me laugh every time I hear it. But he delivered it with this very straight read. And like, that's the kind of voice that I'm used to having him do. But when he read our lines, he sounded more like less anime, more understood that this is like a, you know, Midwestern farm game. So he delivered in a way that I really felt was better than any of the other auditions that we had. And so I was like, okay, let's go with him. And my voice director, who's worked on games like Yo-Kai Watch and Devil May Cry 5 and stuff, is like, yeah, I think it'd be really good, but we may have to dial him in. Like, we may have to get him, you know, less, we may have to kind of talk the anime out of him. No, DC fucking came in and just delivered. Like, it was great. He read the script. He got what the script is going for. And so I guess what I'm saying is one, you got to trust your collaborators, but two, give them something to work off of. Some of the worst leadership I've ever encountered is where leadership doesn't know what it wants. So I knew exactly what I wanted, and I wrote an entire script to building towards that. The whole, every line means something. It's not just bullshit. It was trying to sound naturalistic. It was loaded, like a lot of those conversations are loaded with meaning and stuff for the characters that the audience doesn't, you know, it'd be fun to go read a wiki 20 years from now and have people being like, oh man, there's so many secrets in this game. There's so many, you know, hidden meanings to blah. You know, it'd be great to read all sorts of bullshit theories that are completely pointless, because it's fun to do sometimes. But yeah, that's for me, it's giving them enough to work off of that they feel really confident in what they want to do, as well as trusting them when I need to trust them. And that meant, like, if they were like, I want to do this differently, I'd be like, all right, because they've done this before. They know what they can do, and I don't. So I'm willing to at least give them a shot. Because, you know, sometimes they'd be like, hey, what if we try it like this? And I hear it, and I'm like, no, let's try it the other way. And they try it, and they're like, oh, yeah, I see what you mean. Like, it's you got to collaborate. You got to trust other people. And sometimes you got to be like, you know, the reading in my head isn't as good as the reading he just gave. It's going, what will make the best end product? You got to kind of force your ego out of the way, but you got to give them enough to work on too. That's a lot. I know. I'm repeating myself.
That was great. I thought that was very good.
So out of my really long spiel there, is there any questions that you have? Anything I need to clarify? Without spoiling the game, because I can't spoil the game.
I think I want to talk about Fury Road a little later. There's a line of questioning where it fits, but we'll get to that after this one.
So you're a narrative designer. What does that bring to a game's development and construction?
It depends on where you come in the development of the game. How do I put this? So there are a lot of people in AAA video gaming who are not narrative focused. It's partly because of the way that games are made. You have guys who are like, you know, they join gaming as like a tester or a programmer or something, and they, you know, get promoted up the chain and they get more responsibilities. Or, hey, this guy's like a really good artist and now suddenly he's directing a game. And so you have all these people who have different disciplines and different things that they value going into a game experience. But they often come from individual disciplines, which means that how narrative is valued can vary wildly, like super wildly. There are other issues as well. For instance, in the AAA sphere, there are guys who will... In the AAA sphere, there are studios that have production processes that mean they can't get all the actors in at once. There are things about scheduling and booking and where actors are located. There's so many things. And so you may end up having two different voice directors on two different sides of the planet, one in, say, London and one in Los Angeles, and they're both recording the same character for a game. But let's say one's a female version and the other's the male version. I am talking about a real example that I'm not going to really talk about. This is not a hypothetical. There's a you know, male version of the character and a female version of the character, and one of them may be like, yeah, so do your reads like this, and the other may be like, yeah, so the way I read the script is like this. So you may end up having some inconsistency there just because of how they chose to set things up and who they had record. There was a game I was playing where the voice actors sounded really bored, and I was like, these are all really good actors. Like, these are actors I've seen in movies. They're fucking amazing. Why do they sound bad here? And I looked it up, and I realized that the voice director is someone who's been on a lot of games where I thought the voice direction was really flat. So some of it can just straight up come down to whether or not the voice director is conveying the story in a way that sounds good. Like, that, I'm telling you how big this process is, right? Like, you asked me about storytelling, and I'm going all the way down to like the granularity of voice direction, but that is how big it can be. It's like, storytelling is selfish. It is fundamentally the thing everything has to be built around because it requires pacing and flow. Like, if you are playing a game like, you know how everybody says, I ignore the main quest in Skyrim and just go off and like dick around in the world? That's the kind of problem games face. Like, how do we know that a person is looking at the thing we need them to be looking at when the thing happens? Are we scripting it? Is it a cutscene? Will the players feel what we want them to feel based on what's happening? Are they Doc and they're running around in Half-Life 2's red letter day teabagging all the tables while they wait for the story to continue? You know, like, there's a lot of different ways players can approach the game, and the verbs that you give the players can change how they're doing this. So for me, I'm like, story needs to be top down. Story needs to be the first thing you think about, like, before gameplay. Because gameplay is a way of telling a story. It's like when you're shooting a movie, right? If I'm going to shoot a horror movie, I'm going to, like, go to my set designers and be like, you, make this really dark. I'm going to go to my actors and be like, you, I need you to play more campy than normal because we're making a slasher film or something. You know, and every single aspect of how we make a movie, how it looks, how it feels, all of that is designed to support the script that we have. In games, it's like, some creative director is like, you know, I saw this incredible movie the other day. It's called The Road, and I want to make a game like that. And they're also like, also I saw Children of Men, and I like that. So we're just gonna, you know, they bring the entire dev team into a room. They sit them down. They show them clips from the movie, and they go, we're making this. And then they start kind of hashing out what that will be. And sometimes you have people who don't know what they want. I literally once worked with a AAA company. And we asked them where something was that we had seen in a previous game, like it was what the entire game was about. Like, imagine this is not it, but imagine like being pitched a zombie game, and then you go to the studio like 6 months later, and you're like, what happened to all the zombies? But your entire game was a zombie game, right? And they're like, oh, we cut those because it didn't fit with our brand, and now we're making something else. And it's like, how many millions of dollars did you spend, you know? Now you're making like a sci-fi shooter with you know, aliens or some shit. Like, you've completely changed what you're doing. Why did you do that? Like, so when you have that, it's really hard to be a narrative designer when your leads are like, we don't know what we're making. We're just kind of making a thing. And it means that they're like, things can shift, things can change. You can read about like Jason Schreier did a great article for Kotaku a few years ago about Mass Effect Andromeda. And how they, you know, it started out as this really cool project, and then it kind of gradually just became a BioWare game, except that BioWare isn't good at making open worlds, so it became a really bad BioWare game. Because they didn't really know what they wanted. They ended up repeating a lot of their own mistakes. They, you know, it's what happens when you have bad leadership. Like, so much of what you need is good leadership, and you need to put the story first. And I know there's a lot of people out there who resist that. They're like, no, gameplay comes first. Look, gameplay supports the story. There is, if you're having like a split between gameplay and story, it's because you're telling the story poorly. If you're telling the story well, then gameplay and story are going to work together. It's the reason that Halo is great, is because Halo has a story and has a game, and both of those things are completely they're completely interconnected. There is no real delineation between the two. Cortana is telling you what to do in cutscenes. She's also telling you what to do in gameplay, and they are the same goal motive. The cutscenes just kind of grease the wheels. They kind of move things on or give you a reason to split between two locations. Like, they're good. They help Halo work. The reveal of the Flood is the perfect mood setter for what happens. If you didn't have that cutscene, then the first time the Flood appear might be a little weird because they're just like weird little guys and you don't understand how scary they are. That cutscene kind of helps prime you and then helps that. It just greases the wheel of that scene a little bit more. So the role of narrative in games, in my opinion, is that it should come first unless you're making like a puzzle game or like an Ikaruga or something where it's like pure gameplay. Because games are on a huge spectrum. But if you have a story, if you're thinking, I want to have a story in my game, that comes first. And if you wrote a story where the story and the gameplay don't work together, then you've either written a bad story or you're telling the story poorly. So like, if you need a 3-hour cutscene to explain some shit people should have learned in your game, probably just should have made a movie instead. Hope that makes sense.
Yes.
An example of this would be Death Stranding, right? That game, actually, no, we won't do that because that's pretty recent. Let's go 5 years back. Let's go to Metal Gear Solid 5, right? There's a mission in that game called Shining Lights Even in Death. It's one of my favorite missions in any video game ever. Throughout the game, you have a mother base, right? It's your big oil rig in the middle of nowhere, and that's where soldiers are. You kidnap soldiers, and apparently this caused them to respect you so much that you all kind of become one big happy army family on your base. And there's a lot of cool things about that. There's neat stats, like their language, right? Like certain people speak Russian or French or Kikongo. Like, they speak all these really interesting languages. So as you're going through the game, you find out that there is a language transmitted virus. And it turns out that everyone who speaks that language gets the virus and dies, and they're spreading it to other people. So that's bad. And that's because the whole game, like, thematically, Metal Gear Solid 5 is really strong. It's actually stronger than most of the people are giving it credit for. But it's this really interesting game about, like, what is identity and how does language factor into identity? Does your ability to converse with other people, it shows up in Death Stranding as well, like the connections to other people formed by shared language. Like, it has this really cool stuff that it's going for, and it has a disease. It's like, what would happen if you got robbed of language? And so you have this mission where you go into a cordoned off area of your base, and so they've changed the way the base looks to be creepier because people are dead and there's blood everywhere, and it's unsettling because you've been here plenty of times. Like, you've explored your base. You know what your base looks like. This is an uncanny version of your base. So it, just in the art design, they've changed, like, without doing a cutscene, without doing anything, just through the art design, making this thing you know well different is unsettling. And then you start, when you encounter these guys that are infected with the virus, you have to shoot them. And the thing is, as you've been running around the game, there's this cutesy little thing they do where everybody salutes you, like, boss. And sometimes you can punch them, and then they'll get back up, and they'll salute you, and they'll be like, thanks, boss, for the CQC training. It's great. It's like, cheesy, but it's great. In this mission, they know you have to kill them because they have this virus, and it has to be stopped. And so they, like, struggle to stand to their feet and salute you one last time, and it's this huge tearjerker of a moment. Like, it is... The bad guy has won in that moment. He is making you shoot your own men, these men that you personally recruited by kidnapping them, to join your forces. So, like, that is an example for me of where systems in the gameplay created an emotional, personal impact on you as a human that leads to, like, a much more interesting playing experience. And Metal Gear Solid 5 is one of the best playing video games in the world. Like, it has incredible character controller. Just... the ability to, like, run around and, like, jump on a cardboard box and slide down a hill. Like, that game controls so much better than basically anything else in the world. Like, that is a game where gameplay was not sacrificed to tell a story, except for the really long cutscenes. It has, like, 2 hours of cutscenes in the whole game. So, yeah. I think story should come first. I used to think gameplay should come first, but I've kind of realized that, oh, gameplay is how you tell the story. And if the gameplay and the story aren't working, if something is getting in the way, it's not because gameplay and story are at odds. It's because you're probably telling a story in the wrong medium. It's like trying to shoot a Watchmen movie. That happened, and it was bad. The comic is written as a comic. The panels are designed a specific way. You are supposed to look at the panels in a specific way. Adapting it to a movie loses its impact. The Watchmen movie just looks nice because the director, what's his face? Zack Snyder is a commercial director, and so he knows how to make things look nice. But he's not. He just does things for rule of cool. Like, the original Watchmen comics is very considered in why the panels are the way that they are. And changing it to a movie doesn't adapt it properly. You know, House of Leaves could never be a movie because House of Leaves is a book about books. It is a book where, you know, you have notes in the sidelines or single page. Like, you flip a page and the lines get shorter and shorter and shorter until, like, there's one page and the words, like, run or something, and it's designed to scare you, right? You can't do that in a movie. You would be using different language to tell that. So gameplay is a language. That's what I think. Gameplay is a language, and you want to tell your game, you want to tell your game, your story through the medium of games with the language of the gameplay that you want. So you try to find gameplay that fits the story you want to tell. I realize that I'm saying this as somebody who has just like made two very, like, not two, I've made one very mechanics light narrative, but I mean, that was because I had really fucking low budget. It's why on this next game, right, I still have really fucking low budget, but now I can afford voice actors. So I'm still making walking sims, but trust me, I will be making gameplay heavy games and still trying to still tell story with them. I'm just not there yet because money's hard to get.
No, I mean I agree. I am originally when I went to university, I was studying human communication and which is kind of a sociology thing. And right. One of the big people, of course, a very well-known person who's passed at some point, Marshall McLuhan, and his The Medium is the Message, The Medium is the Massage books, which are very interesting books, especially the way they're laid out. They're not just words. They are designed specifically. And it's an important thing, which kind of leads me to the next set of questions that I had written down here. I want to talk about some specific games because you are a let's say student of the first person shooter or the first person game in general, and I myself am also a big long time fan of first person shooters. Take a game. We talk about Fury Road. We talk about mechanics like Halo and those more modern games, but. Looking at something like Wolfenstein and Doom, the early FPSs, maybe not historically the first one, which is some weird French game that very few people ever played, but Wolfenstein kind of cheats on story because World War II is kind of this like easy crutch for anyone making a game or a movie. Like, well, everyone knows what happened in World War II. You don't have to offer context.
Context for morals. It's, you know, very simple stakes. Like, what is there to, you know, set up?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so Nazis. They're easy. You always kill Nazis. That's the lesson. And Doom is similar because you're killing, obviously, demons or very ugly possessed humans. But Doom doesn't have the same built-in backstory that a World War II game does, you know, with Nazis and everything that was happening. It's you're just on a base, and then there's demons, and you're just kind of moving forward.
Like, I mean, maybe, but consider that, like, you're still dealing with what is essentially an alien invasion. Like, at its core, yeah. It's an alien invasion. And most people get that. Like, I mean, we had War of the Worlds. We've had, Night of the Freaks. We've had, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. That's the one I'm thinking of. Like, we have alien invasion stories. So I think it's easy to understand that, even, you know, they're coded as demons and you're on Mars. It's still, the principle is the same. It's an arcade game, right? It's Mario. Like, Doom is Mario. Doom is very simple. Like, save the princess. Okay, shoot the demons. Got it. Like, you walk into a room, they're shooting, and you know to shoot back. You know, I don't think anybody plays Doom and is like, I'm really fucking into this narrative.
True. But do we need more? I mean, Doom, of course, came out decades ago at this point, which is scary because I feel dated by that. Do we need more today? I mean, we have the two Doom remakes of the Doom 3, I guess, is a very different game than obviously Doom 1 and Doom 2 were. Do we need more now than just here's a bunch of guns, here's a bunch of demons, they killed your pet rabbit, go kill everything?
So, I don't know if I'd use the word need, right? Okay. I mean, I think on a very basic level, art is a need. Like, we sit here and we go, you know, I am feeling sad today, so I want to cheer myself up, so I want to do something that cheers me up. Or I'm dealing with a problem in my life right now, and I want to solve that problem, and the way I'm going to do that is by, you know, playing a game, winning in the game, feeling like, okay, I know how to solve a problem, you know, and going through, like, going back to real life and going, okay, now that I feel like I can solve problems, I think I can take this one on. You know, there's like a very basic level that art helps us deal with what we're feeling, or it brings out feelings in us, like looking at Starry Night, right? You see a painting, it's still painting, you know, and you see it and you go, wow, this makes you feel something. Art impacts us. It's a thing we need to make. Like, I think it's inherent in human behavior, right? That we make art. I wouldn't so much say that we need to add story to games so much as now we are able to make games that tell stories. Like, I think with Doom, it's very hard to do because it's all sprites and shit. You know, when you have a game like Metro Exodus and you have like really, really realistic people who can like do performances and stuff, they can generate empathy with you. They can do things like you can just watch a person touch another person's hands, which is really hard, by the way, in games because 3D is fucking hard. Like just little things, like little human interactions. It means you're suddenly empowered to do more. You have the tools to do more. And once you have the tools to do more, I think naturally humans take up that space. Like, when we are able to do something, we immediately fill that void. It's like water. It's like osmosis. Whatever. That's what we do. That's what humans do. I don't think I've ever seen a thing where it's like, oh hey, we have the ability to do X and nobody's gonna do it because why would you do it? Like, if we can do games that look better, we're going to do games that look better, you know, because I think we can tell better stories with better tech. It's not to say that's entirely true. You know, one of my favorite games of all time is Marathon Infinity, which has a really good, involved, and interesting story. And it plays with text in really interesting ways. And it's a fucking 2D sprite shooter too, just like Doom. It's a contemporary. It's Bungie's contemporary to Doom. Like, it's... Yeah, there are... I don't think it's a need. I think it's an inherent or like an inevitable result of improved technology. Just like we didn't have novels before the printing press, you know? Do we need novels? I don't know. But did novels enrich our lives? Yeah, absolutely. Stories have an impact on us as people. No new artistic technology is inherently necessary, but they all enrich us. So... You know, yeah, we could have stayed making games like Doom, but I think eventually people would have tired by doing that. And I think, especially moving into things like 3D, we're able to literally create entire worlds for people to inhabit. We can create new rule sets for those worlds and all sorts of other things, which means we have a greater possibility space. And I'm looking at my computer and I have Battleborn installed for some reason. So, I mean, it's not all aspirational, I guess.
on a similar note, I want to talk about... I'd start with BioShock because it's the one that's it's such a Markler name, BioShock. But the other Shock games before BioShock, System Shock, had the same thing: audio logs. BioShock itself, it's been a long time since I actually completed System Shock 2, but BioShock itself, and maybe not as much the second one, or definitely not as much the third one, tells the story honestly pretty damn well. As you walk through it, you run into crazy people, you hit them with hammers, you electrocute them, you don't hit the big guys with hammers because they're scary. That dude tells you to do things and you do them, and you know, all that pans out. But then you have this proliferation of audio logs. Are they distracting? Is an element like that too distracting? Or, you know, is it just like, oh, you can ignore them, but can you ignore them?
I mean, you can, but like If we go all the way back to the past, right? We go all the way back to the invention of the audio log in System Shock. They could not afford to do 3D human like 3D human enemies. So they were like, okay, we need a way to still have that story. How are we going to do it? And Doug Church came up with the idea. I think it was Doug Church himself, the creator of System Shock and Thief, and you know, now working at Valve on Mysterious Projects, was working on Left 4 Dead 3 for a while. We don't really know what he's doing. The inventor of the Game Jam. This is the guy who's had a huge impact on games. He taught Ken Levine everything he knew, and then Ken Levine fucked it all up. Doug Church is like a really important person in video games. Probably one of the most, like the probably the five most important people in video games in terms of impact he's had on the entire industry. And no one knows about him because he's not like a Japanese game creator who, you know, is like a game by Hideo Kojima, right? You know, he doesn't quite have that. He's a guy who like would show up for work like at 2 a.m. and then work like for 3 days straight and then disappear for a few days. And they just kind of let it happen because he's a fucking actual genius. That's what I heard anyway. And I mean, his coworker was Seamus Blackley, who went on and invented the Xbox. So like, he was in good company. Dude was like they were both MIT dudes. Like, Looking Glass is incredible. But that doesn't answer your question at all. I'm sorry. That's fun history. He did it because of a tech restriction, right? Over time, I think we've turned into audio logs as a way to tell the story. The backstory that a lot of writers are really into, like backstory doesn't fucking matter. This is the one thing that everyone, I wish everyone would learn. Backstory rarely matters. And I realize I just talked about like how proud I am of my game where a guy mentions that his son is dead and that's in the past. But like that's to create a specific character moment where a person expresses sympathy for a man who has to kill him. Like that's it's a very specific emotion I'm going for there, right? A lot of other people like, I want to tell you about all the kooky, crazy stuff about, you know, the lore. Like, I want to give you a snapshot into the lives of people who lived here before all this went to shit. It's kind of a double-edged sword. On one hand, it can be really interesting. The My Cup Runneth Over audio log from System Shock 2 is one of the creepiest bits of storytelling I've ever heard. I fucking love that line. And it is funny that I think you get it in the level where the gravity has been turned upside down and you encounter a church that's upside down, so you see an upside down crucifix when you go in. I believe the My Cup Runneth Over line where he's committing blasphemy essentially by being connected to the many is I think it's supposed to be all thematic. It hits you on the head a little hard, but that's Ken Levine. That's what he does. He writes with the finesse of an anvil. So there can be great audio logs, right? The problem is you play a game like Gone Home, right? And Gone Home's story is actually about a person trying to find her family and not knowing where they are. That's what Gone Home is really about. That is the core of the game. That's what they pitch the game to you as when they sell it. That's what Gone Home is when you play it. They just put all that extra stuff in there because they're trying to tell you a second story at the same time. And it's like, is just having a person telling you, like expositing the past at you, really good storytelling? And I don't think it is. Like, I absolutely do not think it is. Just having a person telling you about their past isn't interesting or meaningful. You know, imagine just sitting there, you know, like fucking McDonald's, and some person walks up to you and you're like, hello, and they're like, hello, and you're like, so what's your name? And they're like, my name's Jim. And you're like, okay, Jim, tell me about your life. And Jim just sits there and tells you. Would you be interested in that? Like, would you really be interested in just a person giving you a series of events? Probably not, unless Jim's a really good storyteller. And so a lot of audio logs are just that. They're just spice. They just exist to tell you about the world before, to convey information. And when an audio log conveys information, it isn't interesting. There's one of my favorite writers of all time, the playwright David Mamet, who did you know, like Glengarry Glen Ross, and The Trial, like a lot of these Oscar-winning, amazing movies, right? Incredible playwright, one of the best of the 20th century. He wrote about storytelling, and he said, sometimes it seems to the penguins, he's referring to the guys in suits, you know, sometimes it seems to the penguins that our job is, it seems to the penguins that our job is to convey information because we write words. And sometimes it seems to us that, you know, our job's communicate information as well, but you wouldn't turn into a movie, like, or tune into a movie for information. I wouldn't. Nobody would. Nobody likes watching stuff just for information. We come for the drama. We want drama. And most audiologues don't do drama. And I think there was this guy I used to respect as a critic, and then he kind of, you know, fell in love with himself and stopped being a good critic because he stopped being self-critical. But he wrote an essay a really long time ago that was like, there's this issue of tangibles in criticism. This idea that sometimes we see something that's tangible and we think, oh, this is the problem or the solution. Like in Bungie, in Destiny right now, a bunch of people telling Bungie, oh, hey, the problem with Destiny right now is bounties. There's a lot of bounties and they tell me how to play. It's like, that's not the actual problem with the game. Bounties are a reinforcing actual problems with the game. We need to change those problems and change what bounties do. And then no one would have problems with bounties because they wouldn't realize that that's the, it's a symptom. It's people looking at symptoms and thinking that's the actual problem. And there's a, you know, real underlying condition. So I think audio logs are a condition. They're a symptom of a condition. They're not the condition themselves. When an audio log is deployed for emotional impact, it's great. When an audio log is deployed just to provide information, it's not that great. Lore is not as important as the very small but vocal lore crowd would have you believe.
That's fair. And I know I was thinking about this. I wish I had thought about this before I even asked the question. But I know you've played The Division and the sequel,
yeah.
Division 2, and I have myself. And one thing that I hate in The Division 2 is picking up audio logs and the echoes. I start an echo just to get the collectible, and then I run out of it as fast as I can because I don't want to see them. It's like totally pointless to me.
Yeah, so it's, again, that's like trying to set up the lore and stuff. It's like, I don't give a shit about that. I want to go fight, you know, Aaron Keener, the guy who created the virus. Like, it's cool to find out what happened, but like, yeah, I'd rather watch a cutscene maybe. You know, and some of the, a lot of those logs are really well written. They sound great. They sound like, you know, the voice direction is great. The information being conveyed is kind of interesting at times. Like, probably the best audio log in all of The Division is Joe Farrow calling his niece. Joe Farrow is the boss of the cleaners, a bunch of dudes who, they're like blue-collar workers who've decided, and rightfully so, the best way to clean out the virus is probably to burn it out. Unfortunately, they're implementation of that policy is to torch anyone who looks like they might be sick.
Well, they're overzealous. They're just very
Yeah, they're very overzealous, and they're, I mean, zealous is a great way to put it because they're, you know, they are zealots for their cause. They are super dedicated to burning the shit out of people. They could, you know, help their community, but no, they want to burn the shit out of people. Like, murder is their solution. So they're dicks. They're real fucking dicks about it. But Joe is the leader of it. And I loved him because in the boss fight, before you encounter him, like most bosses will taunt you or whatever, right? Joe is getting into his flamethrower armor, the stuff that, you know, protects him from the fire and shit, his firefighter gear. And he's asking a guy to help him put it on. And he's like, we gotta hurry, we gotta hurry, we gotta stop these guys. Like, he is panicking because he's trying to save the world and he views you as someone who's trying to stop him. So he's this really interesting guy, right? And the audio log of him calling his niece is, don't believe, he's saying, don't believe what they're going to tell you about me when they kill me. He's like, you got to understand, I did this for you. I'm trying to make the world a better place, a place where you won't get sick. And it's really touching in a way. Like, I mean, yeah, he's fucking crazy and he's a jackass, but he is trying to do the right thing. And it is a good insight into this character that you cannot interact with any other way. And it's personal. And so I love that audio log. It is one of my favorite audio logs in games. But yeah, most of them I don't give a shit about. You know, it would have been better to have cutscenes where you encounter the president doing bad shit and have to arrest him rather than like hearing it in audio logs or watching an echo where no one's moving and they're just saying through audio. You know, do so. They do let you infer. I appreciate that they let you infer stuff, but it's still, you know, it's still a bit. It's missing something. It needs more. So yeah, not wild about audio logs personally. I was gonna do something in audios. We're probably not gonna do it. But I was going to do something where it had all these notes around the house in sticky notes. And it wasn't to give the player information other than to point out that the farmer's wife, before she passed, had Alzheimer's. And so she was leaving all these notes around for herself to be like, you need to take this many pills a day, you need to do that. And I felt like, one, it's not where I want to direct our development efforts, but two, it just felt like it was still telling people the story rather than just letting them live the story. So I've cut it for now. If I can figure out how to make it in a way that will make me happy, I may go back to it.
So name a game that has an ideal, or at least as close as you can to it, introductory/tutorial section.
Crisis.
Yeah, Crisis. The first one.
Yeah, that fucking, you wake up in a plane and you jump out of it immediately. And then it's like, yeah, press this button to move left or right, up and down. And you're like, okay, I got this. And then you land, and it's like, it goes through, you know, you go through the crouching, you go through the, you know, sliding, you can pick up a turtle, like, immediately. I love that they're like, by the way, you can pick up turtles. And in that same level, as you're still learning how to play, actual shit is happening, like, relevant to the plot. It's not just like, you know, like, say, Wolfenstein The New Order, a game I love. I do love the game. But that game is like, you just are doing a generic D-Day thing, and you have kind of objectives throughout that. In this game, it's like, okay, we're going on an infiltration. You go in, and then the infiltration goes wrong, and you find your partner strung up. And the guy's like, oh, shit, let's regroup. And it introduces you to the sandbox really quick. Like, you're going from opening cutscene to, like, proper gameplay really fast. Like, in The New Order, just because I'm making that contrast, in The New Order, you don't really get into proper gameplay until you're, like, the level after the prison, I think. It takes a while. It takes, like, several levels. No, it's before that. It's the first proper Wolfenstein level is when you're at the checkpoint. So you have the tutorial level, and then you have the asylum level, which is another tutorial level, and then you finally have the, like, you go into the basement and you torture the guy, and then you have the, you know, get out of the car, and okay, now you have a full proper shooter gameplay level that you're doing. Like, it takes a while to get into what the actual flow of the game is. And Crisis is like, nah, man, you know how to jump, you know how to sprint, okay. Anyways, here's two or three buildings, an AA gun. We need to go, like, kind of all the way around this atoll. You can take a boat and just cross straight over. You can take on these bases. Like, do whatever you want. We just need you to get to that. And it shows you all the physics you can mess with. It's immediate. Like, it is literally probably 3 minutes from clicking start to the sun rising up and being able to do the gameplay. Because that was the other crazy thing, is in 2007, we didn't have a lot of games with dynamic lighting like that, where you could go from nighttime to daytime so quickly. And it was surprising. Like, I remember the first time playing that going, holy shit, it's daytime now. When did that happen? How did that happen? So yeah, I would say Crisis is probably one of the best tutorials I've ever seen in a video game. It's very short, and that's what makes it work.
Yeah, I would have to agree with the New Order thing, because I remember playing the New Order, like, long after it had come out, because I finally bought it when it was like $10 or something. And by the time I got to the asylum, I was like, I'm kind of over everything happening already. Like, I don't even want to see what's coming next, because it's just like, I've done all this stuff I didn't want to do.
The reason I picked that level is, and I mean, I'm this is coming as someone who loves that game. The reason I picked that level is every friend that I've spoken to who doesn't like the New Order or who didn't want to give it a chance is someone who played that level and went, oh, I understand what this game is now, and I want no part of it. And that's not what the game is, but the game doesn't, like, the game is trying to subvert your expectations. It wants to start off being like, haha, you think I'm a military shooter, but I'm not. And you can't really do that. You can't. It's really hard to do that. That game works best for people who bought into the game, or who are just patient enough to get through it. Or like, I spent my money on this, I'll be damned if I don't, you know, finish it. Like, it's a, I don't know.
It's just really long. It just takes a long time.
How much time do you spend in the plane alone?
Yeah.
It's like a 2-foot wide plane. Maybe if they'd started you, like, on a boat heading to the beach, popping the, you know, front down and just immediately putting you out on the beach and letting you play shooter bits and try to get the feel for how the shooter works, maybe it would have felt better, like a generic D-Day thing where you just immediately start. That might have felt significantly better. But yeah, Crysis is like immediate. It's like, yeah, so this is a physics sandbox game as well as a shooter. We have really wide levels. Do whatever you want. Go for it. Well, and you do, and it's amazing.
I mean, Crysis is a lot is another Fury Road. There's a little bit going on, and then all of a sudden you're on the truck and you're going, and the movie never stops, or the game never stops. Crysis doesn't stop. You just keep killing things and blowing shit up, and
it's got some stealth levels. It's got some, you know, things like that where it slows down. Like it's got a faster and slower pacing because it is a stealth game in some ways. Like you can turn invisible. But yeah, you're right. It does kind of just go. It never sits you with a cutscene for like 5 minutes. It's like, nope, we know you're here to play a game. So the cutscenes are always really short. Like there's at the end of level one, there's that cutscene where you're like, what the fuck? Why is there a ship in the middle of the island covered in ice? And he's like, I don't know. Anyways, I need you to go get some info. Go that direction, okay? We'll meet up later. And you're like, all right. And then you're just free to progress through the level. And it's wide and it's open and you can do it how you want. And that's where that game gets juicy, you know? That's where the game gets really interesting, is yeah, just the ability to mess around with the physics. Cutscenes are often indulgent. I disagree with Valve, right? Valve was like, oh, we shouldn't have cutscenes. Anyways, here's a 12-minute level called A Red Letter Day. I timed it once. It was like 8 minutes. I timed it another time. It was like 12. But like, it's called A Red Letter Day. And it's literally, you meet, you do the run, right? Like where you're getting chased by the guards to the city. And it's really good. Like the whole opening of Half-Life up till you meet Alex is really good. And then you meet Alex and it just, the entire game is ruined at that point. Because she immediately does all the things, like you just have to follow her, and she's like, all right, follow me, I'm gonna open this door here. Hey, don't you think it's cool that we have a secret door that's a soda water machine? Like, you press the button and it opens the door, and you're like, I don't give a shit. And she's like, anyways, I'm gonna introduce you all these people you should probably recognize as NPCs from Half-Life 1. And you're like, I don't care. And then they're talking about, like, you know, teleported cat incident and, like, oh, that's my pet head crab. Don't worry, we cut her beak off, which is not torture. She's a pet now. she will try to turn you into a zombie, but she can't. We took that part away. You know, like, it's doing all this shit, and then, you know, oh, hey, Gordon, put your MIT degree to use to plug in. You go through this whole level that's, like, 12 minutes long. It is a cutscene. And it only exists to give you a sense of the world. Like, it's, which is good, you want a sense of the world, but we already did that with the opening, like, walk through the thing where the guards, like, pick up that can. Like, we've already established this. They're doing it again, but they're doing it slower, and they're having people tell you stuff, and they end the cutscene basically going, Eli knows why you're here. Get to Eli. Like, we did this entire 12-minute cutscene for people to tell you, there's more exposition ahead, buddy. And then we get into the gameplay, and the gameplay is like, okay, and you just go through a lot of okay gameplay, including the way too long canal level, before you get to Eli. And then immediately Eli's like, hey, go fuck around with this thing, I'll tell you what you're here for later. And then you come back and like, oh no, the Combine have attacked. You gotta get to Eli again, because he's gotta tell you what to do. By the way, he's in prison, go get him. So you go over to, you know, through Ravenholm and City 17, and you go all the way to Eli, and you're like, I've rescued Eli. Eli, tell me, why am I here? And Eli's like, well, and then Judas like, I'm kidnapping Eli. And you're like, fuck. And then Eli gets kidnapped. I don't even remember why I'm reciting the events of Half-Life 2 other than to say, like, fuck the whole it's the cutscene shit, right? Like, that whole game is, like, so proud that it doesn't have cutscenes. But you know what? Because it doesn't have cutscenes, you somehow get in a teleporter accident that causes 2 weeks to go by. So they made a time machine where you can jump into the future. And they never talk about the implications of this. They just did that. And they did it because they couldn't have a cutscene. They couldn't have like a, oh, and 2 weeks passed. So they make you jump forward in the future. And then the Rebellion, who's all like, we, you know, don't trust anybody because, you know, we shouldn't, because it's, you know, self-preservation, and we're a Rebellion, and Rebellions are generally not known as trusting people due to the fact that they're trying to survive and fight a resistance. You know, it's the whole thing. They're like, you know what? That mysterious dude who showed up, and every time he showed up, our boss got kidnapped, and systematically our entire leadership was dismantled. You know that guy? And everyone else in the rebellion's like, yeah. And they're like, well, he just disappeared with Eli in a known Combine stronghold. And all the resistance people are like, yeah, definitely. Like, clearly, Gordon is definitely the chosen one now, even though he somehow kidnapped Alex and, you know, he was responsible or at least present when Alex and Eli and Judith, who they didn't know was a traitor at the time, even though all three of those people who are in our leadership are fucking missing now, Gordon is definitely the guy. He's the chosen one. He's the, you know, fucking guy who's going to free us all. He's been gone for like 2 weeks, so what if we just started rebelling, like, by ourselves? And they have the Combine on the ropes. Like, you're playing the game, and it's like, it's clearly, they're not winning, but it's very clear that they're fighting Combine. And when you're asking for an explanation of why this is, it's like, these people decided you being missing for 2 weeks was the catalyst to start rebelling. It's like, why didn't they just do this before? They're clearly doing pretty good. Like, they got Breen, like, worried now. And that's the problem I have with that game, is if a cutscene would have done a better job, because there would have been a reasonable reason to do things, and instead it's just like, yeah, this guy showed up and all of our leadership was destroyed and he was claiming to be some dude from the past. He's probably, like, realistically, I think most people have been like, oh shit, the Combine suckered us somehow with the Gordon Freeman clone or some shit. Like, instead they're like, yeah, this makes perfect sense. We should rebel now, even though he's not here and we have no leadership now. Like, they did the opposite thing of what you would expect them to do. In a cutscene, you could have had, like, you could have had, like, a thing where, like, Gordon's like, no, they kidnapped the dude. Like, not Gordon speaking, but, like, you know, Alex could have been like, they kidnapped Dad, and Judith was a traitor. And, you know, they got him in the tower, and we have to, like, shut the tower down. And then people could have been like, well, with Gordon on our side, we can do anything. And then started rebelling. But instead, it's a mysterious two-week forward teleport because they refuse to have cutscenes. So you got to be thoughtful with your cutscenes. And Crysis has a great tutorial level because it is thoughtful with its cutscenes and its overall pacing. The pacing is really short. Like, you don't have to spend 20 minutes doing shit that you're not going to do for the rest of the game. It's like, here's sprinting. Here's picking things up and throwing them. You know what to do. Here's a general sandbox level to kind of give you a way to play with our mechanics. Have fun. That's a better tutorial. So I'm sorry for going into why Half-Life 2 is a piece of garbage, but, you know, there you go. No, there's my tutorial. By the way, I think Half-Life 2's tutorial is actually really good. But it also, you know, once it gets to a red letter day, it you learn what the game's all about, which is refusing to do cutscenes where they would make the game better.
That's fair. I mean, this is about game design and choice and design here. So beating out Half-Life 2's problems is a good thing.
Generally, it's like, spend as little time annoying people as possible, because people have to play your fucking game. Like, don't do shit players can't, you know, engage with. If you're doing a really custom opening level that doesn't hold any bearing for the rest of the game, why? That's a waste of resources. It's a waste of interest. It is making your players go, like, I don't really understand what the game's about. Like, Assassin's Creed Origins is bad in that you're, like, fighting these dudes and really mad about it, and you don't know why as a player. Like, you're like, why do I care? Who is this guy? What's going on? But this is why all TV shows are like, we're going to establish who our characters are in every episode so that people get it. Like, every good TV show you've ever seen, I guarantee, is one that makes it clear who all the characters are pretty quickly so that someone who's channel swapping can just, like, start tuning in and being like, oh, I like this now. Because that's literally how a person who wrote on, like, Boston Legal and The Good Wife and other stuff, that's what they were telling me about. It's like, yeah, that's how a lot of TV shows work. And so we write ours. Also, they said James Spader is amazing and just wonderful as a person, which is great to hear. But yeah, like, he was in one of those shows. Yeah, it's... You need to make people care quickly, and then you need to kind of get out of the way. The more barriers you put between the player and, like, being able to interact with the game, the worse your game is going to be. So the longer a tutorial level is, generally, in my opinion, the worse it is. The crisis level is long, but the actual tutorial part is basically up until you find your dead partner, which is like 2 or 3 minutes. And then it's just this huge open sandbox and like do what you want. And it's not like a big open world game. But like when I'm playing a game like Horizon Zero Dawn and I'm spending like 8 hours in a limited open world area before I can go out and explore, I'm not having fun. Like I'm bored.
Yeah.
And that's a problem I have with a lot of games is the barriers they put between the player and the game experience. Like you should generally get the player to the core loop of the game as quickly as possible. And I'm saying this and I'm making a game this does not apply to. Like there are games where this does not apply. I get that. And then The Witness is really good. You walk down a straight line, you see a single puzzle, it's just like click here, drag here, okay, now I know how to play the game. And then you're free to do whatever. That's also a really good tutorial. Even if John Blow's kind of a pretentious nut. Sorry.
That's going to do it for this half of the Doc Buford episode, Titans fans. Tune in 2 weeks and listen to the second half, where we come full circle on everything, essentially. More Half-Life 2 ragging, discussion of game design, and, of course, Doc gets a little bit more into Adios and Shipbreaker.